respond to a message from God's word, I invite you to open to the book of Daniel. We will be going to the second chapter as we continue today talking about something that we began last week, that something is resilient faith. Because there is a reality that we face in this life, and that reality is we live in a very post-Christian, post-faith, not just Christian, post-faith in anything beyond ourselves, society, and culture. It is increasingly grown more and more against any notion of any kind of morality or ethics that would be beyond ourselves. We want to, just like the original sin in the Bible shows, we want to be able to choose right and wrong for ourselves. So anytime we come before anyone that doesn't believe in anything outside themselves in our culture, it seems like there's immediate resistance. Because are you telling me I can't choose for myself what's right and wrong? And the reality is there is right and wrong. There is good and evil. And it has been defined by the creator of the universe. Shall the clay tell the potter how he should be made? And so often we try to tell God how he should have made us, when what he made was perfect, what he made was beautiful. But we live in a world today that wants nothing to do with God. We live, in a sense, as exiles, just like Daniel lived as an exile in Babylon, in a culture, in a nation, in a world that wanted nothing to do with the one true God. What are we to do? How are we to stand against such opposition? Because in such a world, we have seen not only has the church by and large lost its influence on society, its relevance in society, many faithful have flocked away, have slowly drifted away. And once again, we could blame things like COVID as the cause, as the root cause, but COVID only accelerated what was already happening. And the reality is we hadn't, as a church, by and large, across our nation, across the Western society, developed what we are calling a resilient faith. Rather, we have developed a spiritually anemic faith that didn't understand just some of the basic principles of who it is we are living for, who it is we serve, who it is we believe, hope, and trust in. In particular, as Paul would put it best in Galatians 1:10, for am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ. Many in our day and age are forgetting this. And when we realize, oh wait, you mean it's not about me? We leave and we go the other way. And we see this time and time again in our culture. You don't have to look too far at a Facebook feed to see this person has left the faith in your news feeds. Because we haven't taught people how to have a resilient faith, how to experience an actual faith in their lives, in the face of such odds that we face in a world, in a culture, in a nation that's increasingly hostile to any notion. Which brings us to the book of Daniel today. It brings us to the second chapter, and we're going to read the first 16 verses because Daniel's life story, the history here in the book of Daniel, tells us how we can have just this, how we can have a faith that stands in the midst of oppression, in the midst of persecution, in the midst of challenges and trial, how we can have a faith that not only stands but thrives in such situations. It says in Daniel chapter 2, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. Then the king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. And the king said to them, I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. Then the Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, "The word from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you show the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and its interpretation." They answered a second time and said, "Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show its interpretation." The king answered and said, "I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time because you see that the word from me is firm. If you do not make the dream known to me, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the times change. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me its interpretation." The Chaldeans answered the king and said, "There is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand. For no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing that the king asked is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh." Because of this, the king was angry and very furious and commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. So the decree went out, and the wise men were about to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He declared to Arioch, the king's captain, "Why is the decree of the king so urgent?" Then Arioch made the matter known to Daniel. And Daniel went in and requested the king to appoint him a time that he might show the interpretation to the king. Now, we have to ask when we're reading this, what's really going on here in chapter 2 of Daniel? What's really taking place? Why would Nebuchadnezzar make such a ridiculous request? Because it's pretty ridiculous if you ask me. I mean, it's just, he's asking them to tell him what he dreamed about and then give the interpretation without telling them any idea, giving them any clue of what he dreamed about. Would anyone like to try to do that? I had a dream 3 days ago. Would you wager your life that you could guess what I dreamed? I didn't think so. There's something more going on here. Nebuchadnezzar has caught on to something. Nebuchadnezzar has caught on to a little human condition we all have to elevate our own status above others, as well as to tell people what they want to hear rather than what they need to hear. And let me tell you, all these people that Nebuchadnezzar surrounded himself, they were perfect at it. They had made an art of this, of manipulating the king and telling him what he wanted to hear, not what he needed to hear. And this is why he says, "If you do not make the dream known to me, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the times change." And in particular, that's in verse 9, if you want to look at that again. And what does he mean by "until the times change"? He's talking about until he's off the throne and there's someone else in his seat, which they would just then surround themselves with this other king and try to get all buddy-buddy up with him. They would tell him what he wanted to hear, not what he needed to hear, so that the king would appoint them higher places in the empire and that they would have just all the fame. They would have all the glory for themselves. And they made an art out of this. They were so good at manipulating those in power to achieve power for themselves. And that's what had been going on. And Nebuchadnezzar finally caught on to it. And so he comes up with this ridiculous challenge. He really had a dream, and we see that, but he really wants to know the interpretation. He doesn't want to hear what he wants to hear. He wants to hear what he needed to hear. So Nebuchadnezzar sets before them this impossible task to see who was really authentic and who was not. Only come to find out that all the people he surrounded himself with were completely inauthentic. They even say, "There is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand." And you want to know, they were right. There wasn't a man on earth that could do what the king was demanded. No one can show the king except, they say, the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. And they're partly wrong with that, because there's only one true God. There's only one God who could actually do this. They were right to a point. They were right to say that this was an impossible task for any ordinary man. It was an impossible task. It was just an uncanny request. They were unable to cozy themselves any closer. They weren't able to circumvent their way out of this. And so the decree went out that all the wise men should be killed. And it lets us know that Daniel and his companions were included in this bunch. Daniel and his companions were included. And this is where Daniel enters in. The king sniffs out the lie. He sees the lie for what it is. And this is where Daniel enters in. He hears all about what is happening. And what does Daniel do? It says, in prudence and discretion. Daniel's careful. He's not just barge in and say, hey, what's going on? No, he's very discreet. He's very careful. Hey, can you tell me what's happening? Why is all this going on? Apparently, he wasn't with all the other people when the king made his command. And the captain of the king's guard, who was ordered to kill him, tells Daniel, this is what's going on. The king wants them to tell the dream and its interpretation. And what is it that Daniel does in the face of this impossible task? I want to go see the king. Well, the king wants to kill you. No, I'm going to go see the king to get a time to actually achieve the task that he set before us. I want to go see the king to get a proper time needed to do this. What do you think Daniel is actually trying to do here? If we brought this story into the present age, what do you think Daniel's actually trying to achieve? Some, I know of myself, preserving nature and what my flesh would try to do. It's time to get out of Dodge, as any good old Western would teach you. You know, Daniel's like, I can get some time, pack my bags, and go, right? That's what Daniel's trying to do, right? No, it's not. You know, if I read outside the text a little bit, I can even see Arach going, really? You're going to do what no one else in Babylon can do? You're going to say that you can not only interpret the dream, but you can tell him what the dream is without even knowing what the dream is? You're going to do that? I'm going to send a couple of guards with you just to make sure you don't try to skip town. You know, I can see the captain of the guard doing that, and I can see all the other wise men and these magicians, these sorcerers, as they would call them, these people that supposedly had these mystical powers, but really, it was just a bunch of mirrors and lights and smoke. I can see them talking with one another. Look at this stupid Jew. Who does he think he is? How does he think he's going to do this? We can't even do this. There's no way to talk around this. The king asked an impossible task. But what is it that Daniel does? If you've never read the book of Daniel, we're going to talk about that. If you've read it before, you know exactly what he does. But just in case we haven't, Daniel intends to do exactly what he tells the king he would do. Daniel intends to meet this impossible task and to achieve this impossible task. He has every intention in his mind that he can tell the king what he dreamed and the interpretation of what the king dreamed. Why would Daniel do such a thing? I mean, he's really putting his life on the line here. As I said, it's time to get out of Dodge. It's time to skip town. It's time to leave and never come back, Daniel. The reason Daniel can is because he has a resilient faith. He has a resilient faith because his faith is a faith that experienced the power of God. His faith is a faith that experienced who God is, what God was capable of, and what God does and continues to do. And in this, he had faith in God's ability to see him through this impossible situation. He had faith that God would see him through this impossible task. He had experience, first-hand experience, second-hand experience, and third-hand experience of who God was. And that's our ticket for today. If we want to have a resilient faith, we need to have a faith that truly has experienced Christ. Daniel speaks out in faith in the midst of this impossible task, in the midst of exile, because he had experienced God to be so, so good. And he had experienced God's ability to do such things. He knew through experience that God was capable. And so he boldly rose to the occasion. He boldly rose to the impossible situation. He boldly said he would do what no one else could do because he knew who his God was. This is what actually happens in verse 17 through 24. It says, "Then Daniel went to his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, 'Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and might and have now made known to me what we asked of you. For you have made known to us the king's matter.' Therefore, Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, 'Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show the king the interpretation.'" God does exactly what Daniel knew God would do. Last week, we discussed how God is faithful to those who are faithful. Daniel, through life experience, knew this. So what is it that Daniel does? He goes directly to God. Not just him alone, but he surrounds himself with others who would go directly to God with him. He surrounds himself with others who have had the same experiences in life that he had, that who knew who God was, what God was capable of, and what God would do if they would faithfully seek after him. And then we see, after Daniel has revealed what it is the king dreamed and its interpretation, what is it he does immediately next? He worships the Lord. He worships and praises God and honors God and thanks God for the revelation that God had given him. But more importantly, Daniel recites in faith what he knew about God. He recites in faith, word for word, who he knew God was and what he knew God was capable of, and what he knew God would do. And this is what we see. And then he goes back to the captain of the guard, the person who was sent to kill him. Put yourself in that guy's shoes, and you see Daniel leave. What are you thinking immediately? He's getting out of Dodge. He's getting out of town. I'm never going to see this man again in my life. But then here comes Daniel strolling up the next day. Okay, what's going on? I figured they would have to bring him back in chains. What's going on now? Daniel's just coming back. And not only does Daniel just come back, he says, "I have the answer." And I can see this captain of the guard go, "You have the answer. Okay, I will let you into the king, but that's on you. That's not on me. You're losing your head is on you." But Daniel comes back, comes strolling in, not because he's trying to be deceitful to the king, because he has the answer for the king's matter, as the text shows, as he praises God that you have revealed to me the king's matter. You have revealed to me what it is that is needed for here. I knew you to be faithful, God. I knew you to be capable. And that's exactly what you did. And this is what happens in verse 27 through 28. Daniel answered the king and said, "No wise men, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show the king the mystery that the king has asked. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. And he has made known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head as you lay in bed are these. And he goes on to explain the dreams in vivid details. And then he goes on to give the interpretation of the dream. But Daniel makes something clear here. King, you asked an impossible thing. Impossible for man, but something that was very possible for God. Where I and everyone else was incapable, I know who is. I know a God who makes the impossible possible. Daniel expresses how through his life experiences, he has seen who God is, what God is capable of, and what God has done and will continue to do. And in this, we see Nebuchadnezzar respond. And his response may seem surprising. The king Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and paid homage to Daniel and commanded that an offering of incense be offered up to him. And then in verse 47, it continues. The king answered and said to Daniel, "Truly your God is God of gods and Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this mystery." Then the king gave Daniel high honors and many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. The truth will always be revealed. The truth will always come to light. The lies will always be revealed. Exactly what happened right here in this text. The lies of all the wise men was revealed. The truth of who God is was revealed. And God sets things right where they were so out of order. And that's exactly what God will do in each and every one of our lives if we can learn to live a resilient faith. Where our life is out of order, where lies are assailing against us, where our adversaries come against us. As our psalm, when we opened the word today, when we opened our worship today, said in Psalm 27, he lifts our head above our adversaries. He lifts us up. He allows us to echo the words of the psalmist in 23:5, when David says, my cup overflows. And there's something that this chapter shows us beyond all things when it comes to having a resilient faith. It shows us not only what it is we need to have, but how we have it. It shows us we need to have authentic relational experience with Christ. For most Christians in today's world, their relational experience with Christ is summed up in a one-time prayer at an altar. For many, they don't even have that. They don't even have that moment or that conversion experience to talk about. Because we have summed up an entire relationship of Christ in the church, by and large, across our culture, to a one-time prayer at an altar. Forgetting that it's not a call to a single prayer, but it is a call to a lifelong journey of experience, of walking, of living with Christ. It is a call to a life that is lived, not just a moment that is experienced. And when we have a life that is lived with Christ, and I use that as the past tense purposely, because it is through our lived experience that we develop this resilient faith, that we develop this mindset and attitude that says, that's impossible, but I know a God who makes the impossible possible. I know a God who reveals mysteries. I know a God who can answer the king's request. I'm willing to bet my life on it because I know who God is, I know what God is capable of, and I know what God will do and continue to do. Resilient faith, like Daniel, has a deep knowing and relational experience of God. An anemic faith has no such experience. And to describe the opposite, I have a story about a man. This man was very well known, like learned. He knew a lot of things. He knew about a lot of things. He could do a lot of different things. He was a very accomplished man. He was very intelligent. But there was one thing he had never had the opportunity to do, and that was paint a house. Sure, you give him a canvas and a paintbrush, boy, he was a regular Michelangelo. He would paint you the most beautiful masterpieces, but he had never painted a house. And if anyone has ever tried to paint the walls of a house, in any sort of darker color, you know that it's no easy task of just putting a roller on the wall. That there's a technique, there's an experience you need to do it and do it properly, or you're gonna have bubbles, you're gonna have lines, and then splatter. You know, first time you ever used a paint roller, I guarantee you there was splatter everywhere, wasn't there? You learned you need to put drop cloths down because of all the splatter. I know the first time I ever tried to paint a wall, I ended up with more paint on myself than I think the wall had on it. The point being, he had never painted a house. So you know what he did? He started going to his local Ace Hardware store. He would go to the paint section once a week and just sit there and learn as much as he could about painting a house. He would learn about the tools of the trade, the different kinds of paint, the different sheens you could get, and what you would use in what situation. And he sat there and he learned from the workers as much as he could take in, as much as he could grasp. And then he realized, wow, Ace Hardware is limited on what they can do. You know, they're not really dedicated to paint. So you know what? They can't teach me anything more. They can't show me anything more that I don't already know. So he's like, I'm going to go to a better hardware store, one that dedicates itself to painting houses. I'm going to go to Sherman Williams. And so the man went to Sherman Williams, and he realized they're teaching me the exact same thing that Ace Hardware was teaching me. So he begrudgingly went to Lowe's. And when he got to Lowe's, he realized they knew even less than Ace did and Sherman Williams put together. But then there was someone that came up to him and asked him, do you know anything about painting a house? He's like, I know everything there is to know about painting houses. Good, I need someone to paint my house. Could you come and paint my house for me? I've never done it before. I could tell you how to do it, but I don't need someone to tell me how to do it. I need someone to come and do it. To this day, this man has never laid a paint roller on a wall. He hung his head down in defeat and left his dream of painting houses altogether. Many times, this is the reflection and poster child of the state of the modern-day disciple of Christ in our culture. We have all the knowledge in the world. We have Bibles galore in our country. In fact, if you don't have a Bible, we have Bibles out in the foyer for you to take home with you. We have all the resources at our fingertips that we could ever want and desire to teach us more and more about Christ. We can know everything there is to know that has been revealed. And it's all right here. But you know what? Excuse me. Knowing all this means nothing if we never first experience who Jesus is. To have a resilient faith, we must have more than knowledge. Not that knowledge is a bad thing, it's a great thing to have. But if we lack experience, we'll never truly be able to be a follower of Jesus that can stand in the midst of the pressure and the tests of faith that come to us each and every day in our culture. We must learn to have an experience of Jesus, not just knowledge of Jesus. We must learn what it means to live and walk with Jesus, to have that deep relational knowing, the same knowing that Daniel had. We must dare to be different. We must risk to be different. We must seek and desire to develop a resilient faith, for the day is coming. And coming soon for each and every one of us where we're going to face that ultimate test. And we're going to need a resilient faith to persevere. But not just persevere, to thrive through it. That is if we don't want to end up like another statistic. How is it we do it then? Daniel 2 shows us how it is we do just this. How is it we do it? Living by the GEIGO principle alone, garbage in, garbage out, like we talked about last week, is not enough. And we must apply it to more than just our media intake. We should apply it to every part and place of our life. Because the reality is, if you look at your calendars, they're full of stuff. So much stuff. In today's world, we pack so much stuff in the so little room we have of time. In fact, it was said by Buckman and Hart in their book, Hope Against Hope, that says it best. The horizon of our own finitude haunts us. And we rush, We rush to cram as much as we possibly can into the available space, traveling ever faster and further, seeing and tasting more, trying out as many options as we can while we have the time, and ironically, as a consequence, having time for very little at all. Has there ever been a generation with so little time actually to take time and to enjoy the world? I would add to their statement here, has there ever been a generation of Christians with so little time to actually take time to enjoy the presence of God? So often our lives look like my garage looks right now. And bear in mind, we just moved, and I have a picture of it for us. That's our garage. And I'm going to tell you something right now. There's some important things in that garage, things we haven't found yet. But if you ask me, what sort of important things? I know there's important things in there, things I haven't found yet, and I'll know them when I find them. And you said, well, could you go get one? No. I'd have to unpack the entire garage to find those things. I'd have to take it out, box at a time, to get to those things. And that's exactly what we're doing. And Jeanette, I know you're probably watching online in the nursery. We're going to take it one box at a time, honey. One box at a time. And trust me, this looks a lot better than it did. For those who helped move us, you know this already looks a lot better than it did. But the point being, so often this is how our life of faith looks. We've cluttered the garage with so many things, so many activities, so much stuff. I think about a retired friend that I had that said, gosh, I didn't realize how busy I was until I was retired. And then my life got really busy. When most of us look forward to things like retirement, because that's the time when I'm going to have time. But we are so good at packing our lives with so much stuff that we leave little to any room for Jesus. Jesus is in the clutter somewhere. He's in the mess somewhere, and I assure you I could find him if I really tried. But all too often we pack so much in to the point that it's overflowing, that we have time, little time, for anything at all. No time at all. The point being, once again, so often this is how our lives look. This is how our schedules look. We leave little room in our lives to truly experience God. When God is right there with us, God is amongst us, God is moving amongst us, in us and through us. He is with us. He says he will never leave us. That's Jesus' promise to us. He will never leave us. He will always be with us. Even in a world that wants nothing to do with him, he will be with you. Even in the midst of exile, he will be with you. Even at your work, where no one else can care less about your Jesus, he is with you. He is with you. He has never left you. How are we doing at taking time to spend time to experience him? Which is our challenge for today. Because we understand to have a resilient faith, we need to have a life-lived experience of Jesus that lives off of that experience, that thrives off of that experience. And that experience is right next to us each and every moment of each and every day. I had a pastor friend of mine when I was telling him what it is we were going to be talking about today. He's like, oh, I got a great resource for you. And this was on Saturday. So I was like, well, it's kind of hard for me to read a whole book right now. But he says, no, you need to look at this real quick. And he sent me a page of this book called A Game with Minutes. There is a reference to it on the back of your worship pamphlets that actually will take you straight to that on Amazon. A Game with Minutes. And what it is this author does, this author challenges us to set an alarm. He wanted to get to the point where he would think about God every minute of the day. But what my pastor friend said is that it brought him to a place where when he was in his office, he set an alarm for every 30 minutes. And every time that alarm clock would go off, he would look at the empty chair in his office, and he would welcome Jesus. He would say hello. And he said, sometimes I'd be led to just sit there in silence, to sit there just in the presence of God, knowing that God was with me, being mindful of the fact that God was with me. Other times, I'd be led to moments of deep, thought-felt, heartfelt prayer, that kind of prayer that Paul talks about where our spirit groans too deep. for words. He's like, it was fascinating. He's like, for the first time ever in my life, I realized that Jesus was right there. He was right there with me. And he said other times he was led to go on a walk. And so he would go on a walk, and lo and behold, there would be something that he was needed for right out the door of his office, something that God had prepared for him. There are other times where he was told to just do this with his Bible and read. He said it was the most life-giving year he had ever had, that he grew so deep in his relationship with Jesus just because he took the time, just because he made the effort to acknowledge the fact that Christ Jesus was with him. Church, that's how we begin to experience God. That's how we begin to develop a resilient faith. It's clearing out the clutter of our lives and choosing, like Daniel chose to do, to go straight to God in each and every moment of each and every day. To go straight to God. But there's even more to this that Daniel shows us in the how. He doesn't do this alone. He surrounds himself with others who would seek God just the same, who had the same experience that he had, knowing that God was who God said he was, that God was capable, and God would do what he says he would do. And so he surrounded himself with others to do just this, to take some time in the presence of God. Find others that will do this with you. And you might say, gosh, taking a minute every 30 minutes, that seems like a really daunting task. I don't know if I have a minute every 2 hours. Start with just a minute a day. And then make it a minute every 8 hours. And then make it 2 minutes every 8 hours. Get into the practice of practicing sitting with the Lord. Get in the practice of practicing, experiencing what it is that God has for you in a moment. Because he is with you, and he is moving around you. Would we but just take time to open our ears to hear, and open our eyes to see, open our hearts to receive. To have resilient faith requires us to have actual lived experiences with Jesus. And this is just but one suggestion I can give you, amongst many others that the book, The Game of Minutes, would give, and how you could do just that. Have lived experiences with Jesus. For our God is alive and active, as he was in Daniel's time, as he was in Jesus' time, as he is still today. He is the same yesterday, today, and forever, and he is still on the move. Would we but wake up and see this and develop this thing that we're calling resilient faith. This is the word of the Lord. The grass withers and the flowers fade, but the word of the Lord remains forever. Amen and amen. Thank you, Lord Jesus, for your word. Help us to respond accordingly to it right now as we go into a time of reflection and of response.